It's May 31st. We're brought to you by TechGC and the powerful, powerful presence of Chris Sands, the producer.
Him and his cape.
What a producer. What a star.
What a star. I mean, look, man, it's hard to show up here at once a week and be in that the limelight that he brings along, you know?
Yep. How are you, man? How are things?
Man, obviously, we had a tough week at work last week. Everyone knows it. Its final round of layoffs. It's not a fun experience for anybody, especially not the people who found themselves departing from the company. And I'm really sad to see some really good friends and smart talent go. Now for the rest of us who are still here, we got to figure out how to optimize the resources and the people we have to do the best work we can. And like, that's the work. That's what we're up to right now.
Yeah. Yeah. That's obviously not easy. Anyone who's been through layoffs and such understands that that's never about the person's skill set and talent. It's simply about the company's economics and the future.
Yeah.
And it's tough.
Yeah. So, you know, I feel fortunate to still be able to work here and work on the mission I care about. But it'll be a tough goings for a few weeks. We'll like figure out how to adapt and then do the best work we can, dude. It's that simple. I don't think, you know, I can over intellectualize this thing, but we had more resources and more people a few weeks ago than we do now. And we still have a lot of work to do. So we have to figure out how to make it happen. It's just like, that's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of someone who makes it happen.
Yeah. Steve, man.
Steve Blickensderfer, great guy, great lawyer, great name, great mustache, everything.
Yeah, man, he's a good guy, man. I've known him a long time, and me and him sort of cut our teeth together at the firm when we were pretty junior lawyers, man. I'm a little older than him, but not by much. And
what was it like when you met him at the firm?
You know, it was very cool, man. Like, he joined the firm after I was already there, if I remember exactly how this played out. I had worked with a great partner. His name is Dennis Ollie, who honestly, me and Steve and lots of people can point to as like a pivotal. We got to have him on the podcast one day. Like, he has sprung more
talked about him a lot.
Fancy tech lawyers than I can count. Okay. Like, and he's not a tech lawyer, man. He's just a good guy. Anyway, Dennis, brought me and Steve together, and we developed a great friendship. We collaborated on some client projects, and then I left the firm. And we stayed in touch, and his career bloomed, and he became the video game czar, legal czar. And we're going to talk about it later, so people are going to hear the details. But like, I'm pretty confident the first time I ever appeared on a podcast was on his podcast years and years ago, which was super cool.
It's pretty amazing when I meet anyone that forges a path down anything new in the legal realm and does that in a very complex space. Yeah. And now he's in a place where lots of people are aware of the legal issues, the myriad legal issues that sit inside these like games companies. But I certainly wasn't aware of it at all until I started talking to someone like him.
Yep.
I don't know anything about it.
Yeah. Look, man, he knows a lot of things about this video game industry, but his knowledge and like sort of scope is much bigger. I like to simplify, and it's like, he's just a really big brain working on really hard stuff, and he's humble, man. Like, he's not out there, you know, kind of like me on like the LinkedIn world and like talking a lot and like, but anybody who meets him says, oh, this guy's got depth. He knows things.
I had no idea. We get into this in the conversation with him. I had no idea how big his global remit is.
Man,
like, if you think about the data from all these jurisdictions that it's wild.
Yeah. Wild. And if you're going to work for a video game company, I mean, it being based in Korea or Japan is the thing, right? Like, I mean, he's in the mix in like a cutting edge space where, like, you know, video games is a lot like ad tech. A lot of technology like gets used there first and then makes it to other sectors. AI being one of them. And we're going to talk about that. So I'm super pumped to share our conversation with him, with everybody. The guy's just a good guy and he's smart. And we're lucky that he's doing the job he's doing, because he's setting the tone and stage for a lot of foundational thoughts, and not just around video games, but around AI, privacy, and fairness. And he's been doing it a long time.
Yeah. All right. Well, he shaved the mustache.
Yeah, but, super disappointing.
When we do the thumbnail for the episode, I'm going to find a picture of him with the
mustache.
Or
we can just superimpose like a digital mustache. I think that's the move.
No, his is too good.
I think we should all wear digital mustaches. But anyway, whatever. Y'all are the producers.
All right. You're coming in hot. Here we are.
Hey, we're here. What's up?
Nothing. How are you?
I'm good, man. Just had 15 minutes of fucking tech issues. It was a nightmare. But here, you know, it's like we do the same thing every week, and it just doesn't work sometimes. I don't know.
I was coming in here thinking you guys were going to be, you know, no issues whatsoever. Oh, yeah. You've been doing this for years.
Lower your expectations.
Have you met us?
This is a low production value operation here, man.
This is not a new presidential nominee coming in. No tech issues for a tech company kind of thing.
Yeah, we're good.
Yeah, we're good. That's not that wishful thinking, my man.
Yeah.
All right. I want you guys to. Steve is our guest today. I want you guys to, you guys have history. So Pedro, start where you guys met, and then we'll get moving from there. Cause I don't know anything about games and shit. And I know there's a ton of really cool legal issues here. And so we've never had an episode really that addressed games and a company that does that work. And so I'm pumped to dig into this stuff. Cause it's new for me.
Yeah, man. Well, I'll give you the TLDR. It's cool. Like, Steve and I used to work at the same firm. That's where we met, man. Like, how fucking cool is that? We were like green junior, know-it-all, know-nothing types and just trying to figure it out. And what a better place to be like a young associate, huh, man? Like Miami, Florida, like, you know, like at a pretty big but not stupid law firm. Shout out to Carlton Fields for being a cool place to like learn and like do real work. We just had a blast, man, and we stayed friends. And then fast forward a couple of years, I've been in-house now, and Steve made the transition and whatever, and I see him at a conference. And here's the deal. And here's the deal where, like, he became a mystical creature for me. He grew this mustache. It was so epic. Like, he was like – it was like porn star / sage.
Now – and now mustaches are the rage.
Dude, but like, he was a founding father of like mustache avant-garde chic. You know, it was pretty good stuff, man. But anyway, that's a long way of saying I really like Steve. I think he's super smart. I got to work with him for a while and see his brain in practice. And I'm glad we got him here as a guest. And let's talk about all his gaming shit because it's super cool.
Pedro, thanks for the props and recognizing the mustache came before the all fad, these dude. Trend. Yeah, before the fad became real. So now I had to get off that bandwagon for a little bit. Obviously, you see, I shaved 5 years off my life.
Yeah, dude, you look like a young fella right now. This is really strange. For those of you who can't see, like he doesn't have his mustache anymore. I barely recognize him, but you do. You look young and vibrant.
Appreciate it. And I feel like we're doing a disservice by not playing a video game while we're talking.
What are you playing these days? Are you playing anything interesting? Like, what's going on?
PUBG. Is that the game right now? I mean, I feel like I've got to know my product really well. Yeah. And I joined the company. I actually wasn't a PUBG player because, you know, I was a lawyer and I had work to do. Or at least that's what I said in public. But I actually did game. I still do, obviously. PUBG's hard.
Yeah.
And I never really got into it. I never got into the battle royale genre, which is where PUBG is.
Yeah.
And if you're going in there, I was always a Call of Duty player in the shooter genre, you know, growing up with the originals, the World War II version to today, which is the more modern version. But if you're going in like team deathmatch style, expecting to get kills, like 30 kills in a match, you know, nuke the team on the other end because you've got those incremental upgrades over. You're not going to get that in Battle Royale. You're lucky to get a kill any points when you're playing a Battle Royale game. But if you go in there thinking it's like a survival game and you're just trying to make it to the end, the suspense that provides, the experience, it's different. And it's really, it's catchy. So much so that PUBG broke all these Steam records, Guinness World Records when it first came out. And if you look at the top game had the most concurrent players on Steam. It's like 3.2 million players at the same time is PUBG. It's by far. The next one after that is CSGO, and it's like 1.6 or something like that.
Numbers, man.
So what have I been playing? I've been playing PUBG in order to really stay on top of our teams. Yeah. Well, what are you guys doing?
I'm sorry you have to spend so much time using the product, man. You know? Sounds really
It's a hard life, Pedro. Someone's got
to
do it.
I like the way he put it. He's like, well, you know, I got to get to know the product. Motherfucker, you're just playing video games. Which is cool. Andy, do you play video games, man? We never talked about this.
Not now. No? I mean, I think as Steve saw earlier, I've got an 11-week-old puppy on my lap right now.
Oh, my God.
And with kids and such, and I haven't had time. But, someday I hope to revisit. Like, I enjoy them.
Yeah. I'll tell you that I am like the world's like most basic video game player. Like I'm a Mario Kart, Smash Brothers-y type video game player because like I just don't have long attention span, as I'm sure anybody who listens to this podcast knows already. And so like, but I love jumping in for 45 minutes and just playing some Smash Brothers and getting out, or doing some Mario Kart and getting out. And there's a nostalgic value to Mario for me that just like, because I did play video games when I was a kid, like a lot. That just like it just makes me feel good. I'd rather do that sometimes than like watch a movie or watch some documentary about meth addiction or whatever the hell HBO is trying to depress me with that week. Like just get on with some friends online and play some video games is like it's just such a good way to relieve some stress with like low stakes, you know. For me,
that's how so many people made it through the pandemic. Exactly. With Animal Crossings, right? Just a way to tap into just another world and relax for a little bit. So.
Exactly.
Steve, when did you discover, like, it's one thing to like games, which lots of people do. When did you discover like, oh, I can overlap my career into this. Oh, and there's a lot of really interesting cutting edge, you know, not just privacy, tons of interesting legal issues, crypto, in-app purchase payments. All that stuff. So when did you go, oh, epiphany, like this is going to be something for my career?
I don't know if I ever had that epiphany. I didn't certainly set out to do that. I think my advice for younger lawyers has always been master your craft, whatever that is, and let the world come at you or create your opportunities as you go along. For me, I started off as a litigator and then eventually found as a subject matter expertise privacy. And then from there, I was like, okay, now I'm starting to build something at the firm that I was at, Pedro mentioned. Can I start to focus some of the work in an area that I really enjoy? And I really liked some of the, you know, the marketing and the article drafting, but I'd like to write in an area that I, you know, an industry that I'm interested in, you know, join groups that have legal, you know, aspects, whether it be like a bar association. I think I started with the Esports Bar Association. There's a video game bar association. So starting to get involved in those groups out of just general interest and just trying to create a practice and a business at the end of the day. And it was kind of that little snowball that grows over time. One thing begets another. And then before I know it, I was founding a practice at the firm that was focused on video games and esports and
how did you tap into clients? So it's like, it's one thing to like get your own interest going, but then you like, it's a business at the end of the day. Got to tap into clients for that.
No, I think it starts with relationships. You know, first of all, just kind of doing what you need to do in order to excel as a younger lawyer. And then at some point, your colleagues and your friends and your family member, everybody, you know, everyone's kind of advancing in their own careers and they're doing their own thing. And then you might get someone that's like, hey, I need help here. Or you're on LinkedIn and I've met people in the industry on LinkedIn and in real life and at events and whatever. And going to events more than once, right? Going the second year, the third year, you see people again. And then slowly work comes from that, or relationships that lead to, I have someone that needs help on something. And then before I knew it, I was on the periphery of the industry. You know, whether esports was really big at the time, and so it related to some of that. But there's also just content creation influencers. I knew a lot of game industry influencers and content creators. They were putting on events, and that was just one of those things. Once you start to get to work with somebody and you do good work, they refer you to someone else, and then you start to build a little momentum. And so it was really starting off like that. And then at some point, I started a podcast. Shout out to the Land Party Lures podcast, which is in the archives now. But that podcast led me to being on NPR for their podcast that was talking about loot boxes, which was talking about all the laws that impact video game companies. One of the most obvious that's unique to video games is loot box regulation, which really isn't much of a thing in the U.S. At least there was a few bills here and there over time that have been introduced, but abroad, it's definitely a thing. Loot boxes, for those that don't know, are those in-game mystery boxes that you might get the opportunity to purchase for money or in-game currency that you would have to buy. So this kind of like a Russian nesting doll of purchases that you make. But at the end of the day, there are some countries and jurisdictions that will regulate that. Do you have to disclose the odds of what's inside? Do you have to show what's inside before you make it available for purchase? Is it gambling? There's all different angles to it. But anyway, I ended up being on a podcast with the head of the ESA at the time, and a Polygon writer. And that led to work. So it's like, it's crazy. I never scripted or thought that any of that was going to be the result of just kind of dabbling into an area of interest. But if it doesn't feel like work, it feels, you could do it. You could do more of it. And so that's kind of where I found myself in the beginning.
Let's not glaze over Steve's old podcast. I think it was 2018 when I was a guest on your podcast.
And we talked about AI, by the way.
Yes,
we did.
What were we talking about on that podcast?
Early stage,
and
man.
We were talking about AI. And I want to say, and I'm not 100% positive, but I'm pretty confident that's the first time I ever appeared on a podcast. Which, thank you.
There we go.
Now me
there
and Andy go. Have this thing.
I'm taking no credit for this, yeah, but
no, you should
appreciate
take
that.
Credit, man. Because like your format was very, very good, and we had a great conversation. And I remember that day after I took that call in my then girlfriend's kitchen. Which is interesting. But that day, there was a huge like Nike event here in town. I remember going to that Nike event and like Nike talking about AI. This is 2018, I'm pretty sure, maybe early 2019. But it was just super cool, man. And you were like cutting edge. And like, yes, it was a gaming focused podcast, but you took other paths in the conversations and talked about a lot of stuff and then always brought it back to the core topic area. I thought it was really well done, man. You had a good podcast there. So is it still out there? Can people still listen to it or is it gone?
Yeah, no, it's still out there. And I tried to pick some evergreen topics, but you know, eventually over time the weeds overtake even those evergreen trees. But some of that stuff's still good and relevant. The AI topic though is very dated. At this point,
yeah, nobody cares about
that's
it
one
anymore.
Of those it's like technology has totally
nobody,
overtaken.
Nobody cares about AI anymore. You know what's interesting is like one of the reasons I'm being on LinkedIn and everywhere, being pretty vocal about the fact that I was talking about it early, is not self-aggrandizement. It's that like Joy's been talking about AI since like the beginning of time. Like when she was still like doing her PhD, right? Like Kathy O'Neill wrote Weapons of Mass Destruction. How long ago was that? I read that. I feel like I read that book 10 years ago, you know, like people have been talking about this for a long time. People much smarter than I. And like a lot of diverse, particularly women, have been talking about this for a long time. Let's make sure we keep them at the forefront now when everybody else decides they want to talk about it. Let's make sure that like some of those OGs that were really doing the work early at high risk and peril to themselves and their reputations are recognized and seen. And so that's sort of why I'm being a little annoying all over the internet about like, hey, like we've been talking about this for a long time. And like I saw today, for example, that a bunch, I think like 300 plus leaders in AI, of which I'm not included, just to put that out there, but signed some document about like the perils to humanity and how AI can be an extinction level concern. Where were these leaders when like, people, algorithms were like incorrectly executing face recognition and imprisoning the wrong people all over the place in the United States and in other parts of the world, like 5-6 years ago. Where were the calls for organization by these leaders when, like, people were not getting, like, appropriate credit ratings because machines were using characteristics that are prohibited by law or just by good conscience and good faith to determine their credit worthiness? We're like, where were all of these calls? People weren't able to get mortgages. People were imprisoned. People remained in prison longer than they have to. Like, lethal autonomous weapon systems have been making war decisions for 20 years. Like, where have all these calls been? All of a sudden, it's like cachet and everybody's got an opinion and wants to talk about extinction level AI threats. Bro, that's a hypothetical threat that's nowhere in sight. Like, there are lots of real threats out there right now to a lot of people, and we need to focus on those, and we're already distracting from them. It's gone. Like, we've already blown over that narrative. It's really frustrating to me. Interested in you guys' thoughts on that. Obviously, I have a lot of passion around this, but.
I mean, you've been, you and others, talking about it for a long time. I think what's changed is certainly, like, the public consciousness that surrounds generative AI and ChatGPT and the technology that came out. So then you obviously have bandwagon leapers and lawyers and tech people that want to jump in and go to that extinction scenario for whatever, for a host of reasons, right? Like, they're not going there because they're not going there solely because they think it's real. I think, like, my opinion is they're going there because it gets headlines and it gets attention, and they want to be the leader of the pack in having these discussions. Yeah, this issue and these topics have been around a long time. But what I will say is, like, I think there has been a fulcrum moment, and that's what's causing this to happen. And don't disagree with anything you just said before. And think about the way we need to change the dynamic of the discussion going forward. I do think we're in an interesting place, right? Like, something has happened, and I'm trying to pinpoint in my mind when I think about it. And Steve, maybe you have thought too. Like, it can't just be like one technology that happened. Something else. It has to be a culmination of things that happened. And I don't know. The only one I'm pointing at right now or thinking about is the generative AI thing, because that just happened. But I think it's probably some other things too.
Yeah, I mean, it might also, if you consider what else has been going around on at the same time, right? Bitcoin and crypto is not as hot, right? And then the metaverse thing kind of cooled off too. And so at the same time that ChatGPT has got this mainstream adoption almost seemingly overnight, you have just this other, I think, the dynamics in play where you have that bandwagon effect happening. And so, and that oftentimes will drown out those voices that Pedro was referring to that have been kind of at the beginning talking about these issues and not getting credit perhaps, or getting drowned out because of all the discussion of all the good things or the positive aspects of it, of the AI technology and where it's going. So, I think it's a number of things, hard to pinpoint one thing, but certainly ChatGPT was the first time that I looked at this kind of AI 2.0, where it's like, whoa, I was talking about on the episode with Pedro, we're talking about StarCraft AI or AI beating StarCraft, which is the RTS game that I really enjoyed growing, you know, through college and such. And AI beating Go, the game Go, or the best Go player in the world, or whatever it was. That's the AI we were talking about. And a lot of the issues that were being discussed at the time were, you know, where this could go, like that Terminator 2 Judgment Day kind of scenario. But there were also these very sophisticated discussions happening as well that, you know, until a different version of AI came around, and it's almost like they were forgotten or, you know, just kind of drowned out. So kudos on I guess, restoring some of the recognition. As it were. So
yeah, look, and you know what's interesting to me about, like, your work, man, is like AI in video games. Like, Andy, I hear you on the fulcrum moment, but I think we're manufacturing that moment a little bit.
We might
just inventing it, because, like, Like, remember last year's Fulcrum Web 3 moment? Remember that?
Right.
When's the last time you saw Web 3 anywhere, talked about it any place? Let's talk about NFTs. Like, the media hype memification of, like, technological development is something that didn't exist 5 or 6 years ago. And that's what's actually changed, because AI has been evolving at a pretty good pace for a long time. Sure, ChatGPT launched a chatbot that millions of people could interact with, and now this is like people's first, like I'm going to use the word tangible loosely here, but like tangible interaction with AI. But like, guys, we've been talking to Siri for a long time. It doesn't feel the same, but it's the same concept, right? We've been talking to Alexa for a long time. Like, in video games, people have been playing against AIs for, I don't know, Steve, you know better than I do, but for a really long time. And like,
yeah, when did the IBM computer beat the chess master?
Yeah, oh, like, yeah.
That was 30 years Watson ago.
Or whatever. Like, right. Yeah, like, yeah. IBM's, you know, whatever. But I mean, like, you know, chess is a game made for computers to beat people on. Like, it's just it's designed well for people to lose to a computer eventually. But like RPG games, when I was a kid, the AI, there weren't AIs. It was just a computer. It was just running its, you know, sequence, and that's it. Now there's like adaptive video game enemies and shit, man. And they like adapt to your style and beat you even though you figured them out. Like, there is no figuring them out anymore. Steve, talk about that development and how like that is a really like simulated version of an adversarial relationship with a machine. And it's happening in video games right now. It's just fake guns. Wait till the guns are real. Talk about that a little bit. Like, I would love to hear your thoughts on this.
You're right that this has been around for a while, right? We just call them non-playable characters or NPCs. And AI, when you're playing, like, say, StarCraft, and you want to just play by yourself, you just, you know, set a opposing player that's the computer on a particular difficulty. And before, it was they would build like one thing. They would just, you know, maybe they'd get an unfair advantage on the resources. Now it's they're adapting to your play style. The goal is to try to imitate, you know, human activity and behavior as best you can in order to, because you want to interact with something in a video game environment that's as real as possible, so you feel like it's the, you know, virtually the real thing, and that's kind of the aim or the goal. So it has been around for a while, and it's just been iterating over time. And to your point, Pedro, in different ways, right? Even as you chat, you know, whether you're chatting, are you chatting with a real person? Are you chatting with a bot? I mean, this is new versions of just kind of a branch off a tree that's kind of shot off, and say we could also engage with users in so that they feel like they're engaging with other players. Sometimes games, just if it's obvious there's bots, they're going to get, you know, dragged through the mud, or the player's not going to be happy. So there's been plenty of games that say they have, you know, high, because all video games, when they first come out, say it's a success, you know, over time, just the numbers will probably die down. And in order to keep those players who are remaining engaged, you might throw some bots in there. Say it's a shooter game. And if players appreciate the difference between someone who's been playing the game for a while and a bot, and it's an obvious difference, they probably won't be pleased. I mean, me, I go in there, I just get some free kills or really easy kills. I'm okay with that. But some players, you know, very vocal players will probably be not pleased. So the goal would then be to make it a realistic experience. And so there's many different ways you can try to make that happen. And just the technology is just getting better for it.
Where do you think AI is going to go in games? Like, what's the future when you think about the issues you may need to sort through?
Yeah.
Where do you think it's going?
Well, I think one of the things that's kind of been obvious recently is just the creative process could be generated through AI, and just the ability to create versus what you experience in games. That's kind of the distinction I'm making. Like, that is the part that, I mean, everywhere. But video games in particular, a very creative, you know, thing. I think that's where AI is probably more recently going to make a bigger impact. Kind of the thing I'm focusing on, or we're focusing on, you know, is how you harness that power to tackle some of the creative things that you've been doing, you know, by hand.
Yeah.
Historically, I think that's for everybody. But you think of a creative industry, you can't. I can't think of one that's more. You know,
I have a friend who was I have a friend, Steve, who was the CRO at a company I was working at. He then took a job at Epic Games, and he's running like a partnership thing at Epic Games. But one of the things they announced this year and they're working on is this whole suite of apps and AI driven world building things that people can use to more faster, better, you know, more interestingly develop their own stuff and then use it in games. I think that's one place that feels soon and feels achievable in the world. Am I right about that? Is that that where you're going to see impact pretty quickly?
Yeah, no, there's different ways you can go with that. Making something like a tool that others could use. There's that angle of it. And that's the thing that it makes AI so challenging is you have to look at it from so many different angles, right? Are we creating an AI tool? That's a whole nother thing. Are we using AI tools? How are we using it? So the lawyers, right, in the room are playing catch up in many ways, like trying to chase after the business teams that are thinking about all these unique and creative ways to use AI tools that are presently out that are just exponentially growing by the day. So being able to get your hands and arms around that is presently the challenge.
How do you decide who focuses on these issues? Maybe like I'm curious, Pedro, like, because Meta has divisions that have been working on the contours of all this stuff for a long time. So like once there's a fulcrum moment, say what we want about what it is, like now obviously things are happening. How are you guys deciding, all right, well, this team is going to manage these emerging AI issues? And I'd have the same question for you, Steve.
Yeah, look, I'll say this. There's a lot of companies making a lot of noise out there sort of prematurely. I'm really impressed by I've been at Meta now 3 years. We've been working on these things for a long time, and we're taking a different approach than other places. I don't like marketing on the podcast, but like the reality is like Meta is really taking like an open, transparent approach to our AI work, where we're sharing a lot with developers and people just interested in doing their own AI work. And we're not releasing junk into the world, which I've seen some of that out there. To your question about like prioritization, I don't know. Like I can sense some frustration when our company executives speak publicly about like this idea that somehow all of a sudden Meta's into AI. Guys, like the metaverse is built on AI infrastructure. Like Meta's one of the largest investors on earth on AI and has been for a long time with respect to development and innovation and just creating the process power, the process capacity, the processing capacity to do real meaningful experiments that can change the course of people's futures, right? Like our ads, we released a product called Waste. We released an update to our Waste product earlier this year, and it's all about like providing more transparency about how like automated decision-making systems and recommender systems impact the ads you see. And so a lot ad tech, Meta and all the other ad tech companies have been out in the forefront of AI development for a long time. It's just not like sexy user facing AI. What I do see changing right now though, here at my company and like at others, is like the user-facing experience, like being directly engaging with AIs, right? And you see that in chat agents, you see that in other ways. But like the principal way people are interacting with AIs now, at least in their own minds, is with these chat agents, whether it be ChatGPT or Snap's agent or other agents like Bard and whatever, all the ones coming up. It will be interesting to see for me if like the chat agent experience evolves, because this idea that everyone's going to develop this prompting skill, I think is a little bit misguided. Like that's like, that just seems like a primitive way to have it's not really a conversation. I'm like learning how to prompt and optimize my prompting so that I get the output I want. That just seems sort of cumbersome and has lots of inclusion challenges, in my opinion. So we'll just have to see how these chat agents evolve. I'm really excited about the research being done. I don't think we're there yet. And look, at the end of the day, when I look at ChatGPT and other agents, here's what I see. I see a technology that can't discern between true and false. It just can't. It doesn't have that capacity. I see a technology based on probabilistic feedback, right? There's no determinant. Like the AI never knows for sure if what it's telling you is right. It's just estimating what it thinks you want to hear based on what you prompted it. And I think the last bit is like there really isn't a sufficient level of transparency or understanding around like what the foundational data sets are that are driving all of the outputs from the agents being used the most. So like in those three areas, I'd love to see more investment by all the players, because I think it doesn't solve a lot of the problems, but it creates the like information ecosystem where we can go about responsibly addressing the challenges that all of this new human technology interaction is going to create. That's a long way of saying I really like what Meta's doing right now. And I think there are opportunities to do better both here and everywhere else. And I hope we seize these opportunities and not go into reactive mode when things go wrong. And that applies to everybody.
Yeah, for my observations is it started off AI use and just maybe the principles of AI on one or two teams, right? Like maybe like the data engineering or analytics kind of side of things. And then just recently just has been open field for all teams to just try to see how AI could benefit what they're doing or make what they're doing better or increase their productivity or however it is. And so we're kind of in that experimental stage where we're just figuring out how does it work for us? How does it work for lawyers, right? Can lawyers use it? My team, can we use AI and harness its power to get information on the just ever growing, you know, number of regulations that are, you know, seemingly being passed every day, every session? There's just kind of this information overload. Can we harness that to just kind of filter out some stuff? But then, you know, to Pedro's point, you have to put up these guardrails, and what do the guardrails look like? And we have to put other people's guardrails up, and because we are, you know, at the end of the day, helping the company comply with laws and stuff. So, it's every day a challenge. Very exciting, but it's interesting.
How much privacy comes up for you on a day-to-day basis? How much like privacy work versus all the other stuff we've been talking about?
So I started off exclusively privacy, and just slowly after that incorporated the other stuff. So I'd say at least half. Mm-hmm. At least half is privacy, yeah.
And that's global, I'm assuming, right? Like the company. Yeah. Tell everyone. I think people don't like know a ton about Kraft and myself included. So will you like describe who they are and sure. and kind of what they do and what you what that means for your remit as a lawyer?
Right. So Krafton is a global video game company that's main game is and was PUBG, which I referenced before. But the company's based in Korea. It went public since I joined the company in Korea, and they have game studios and offices throughout the world. So a video game company, you know, there's pretty much like the publishers and the developers. We develop and publish our games, which is first party, and also third party games, which is games that we're not the publisher, but we'll publish in markets. So you think of markets, Asian market, NA market, EU market, just global, Latin America, there's just different markets. And so to publish in those markets requires certain finesse. And so, when you think about privacy and or just regulations generally for a truly global company, when I was looking for an opportunity to, so I wasn't looking to leave the firm, right? I saw a wave of talent going from law firms to in-house. And I thought to myself, well, if I want to continue to be diving deep in privacy compliance and privacy generally, I don't want the surface work. I want to dive deep in a program. I want to understand privacy on a global scale. I had this opportunity come up in an industry that I really enjoy. And so that's what led me to join Krafton as their lead privacy counsel. And in that role, I'm basically advising the privacy team on global privacy laws everywhere. Everything is fair game. I'm not just focused on Virginia. I'm focusing on, you know, everything. And it's quite a challenge. And so you learn very quickly about balancing risk and understanding, you know, where are most of our users and how can we adapt a global privacy program, or at least advise the privacy team on a global privacy program that will help us to check the boxes in the most places. So that's kind of the summary of it.
That's a huge huge responsibility if you think about all those countries and the users and the we talk about this a lot, but like the differences in privacy morality from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. What's going to make a user comfortable? What's going to make them feel okay with their data being used? Frankly, in ways like in games, you know, they're not going to be totally transparent, at least like in as it relates to or as compared to like your sort of garden variety interaction on the web, you know,
right.
It's different.
And because the company's based in South Korea, this is a consent-based jurisdiction. It's also one of the tightly regulated privacy spaces compared to like Europe. The good thing about that is I wasn't coming in and it was like, you know, do we really need to provide a privacy notice? Do we really need to, you know, collect consent? That culture already existed, which was great. But it's also a consent-based jurisdiction. And so when you look at the, you know, legitimate interests and the legal basis for processing, sometimes consent's like you're only one. And so you have to think about what does that mean when in Europe they're saying you can't, you know, this level of consent isn't good enough. And so, yeah, it's really challenging to be able to please everyone, especially when you're dealing with finite resources. So it's been a really interesting exercise to go in-house from being in the law firm and to dive deep on a program. And then, you know, the biggest takeaway being every client is different, so different. And to really appreciate their situation requires a little bit of background that hopefully the client doesn't have to pay for, right? Getting up to speed on a client. But it's been really interesting.
I know we gotta go soon, but yeah. I can't let you go without asking this question. Metaverse, AR, VR, games. Obviously games have always been at the forefront of like the virtual reality space, whatever we're gonna call that. What do you see as like for the future of gaming and gaming platforms? Like, what do you see? What does this look like? What does gaming look like in 5 years in the AR VR space? That's the easiest way to ask the question. Like, what does it look like?
I think it's just going to be, you're going to think about meeting up with your friends or just connecting with other people. You're going to do it in game. You're just going to you're going to be able to do more things, I think, on a platform. Easiest example for me right now is take the Fortnite concert series, right? And we did this also with PUBG Mobile, had a Blackpink collaboration, actually won an award. So to have those experiences is one thing. Then to just have different, what other types of experiences can you have? Can you watch competitive matches? We quickly referenced esports, but that's competitive video games, right, at its core. And PUBG is actually a really fun one to watch if you watch it on Twitch or wherever it's available. But what are the other ways you could experience that that's maybe more virtual or just kind of engaging more of your senses? So I think some of the progress will be made in terms of what else can you do online other than just playing the linear game, right? Or a multiplayer game with infinite outcomes. Can you do other things in the lobby? Can you interact with other people? Can you interact with your friends in a different way? I think those are some of the areas that we're going to be venturing next, at least with respect to some of the things that I've seen.
One final question. Did you pre-approve the shaving of the mustache with your wife, or did you just do it and just wait for the reaction?
So one of the reasons I lasted so long was that she liked the mustache.
Nice. Right.
So when I'm telling her, you know, I'm going to shave it, she's like, nope, not now. And then eventually, so I gave her like maybe a year ahead of time warning until finally I was like, all right, this is it. This is when it's coming off. And so, yeah, I had the opposite.
She had a problem. Year. Okay. There's some power in that stash for sure.
Yeah. It'll probably make a comeback at some point. So
good.